Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin wins more national and international cheese awards than any other state or country? Learn more about Wisconsin's cheese-making history at wisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, folks, this is it. It's What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights. I am your host, Katie Kiefer, sitting here behind the mic in the studio for once in my life. We're going to be talking about some new pork processing rules, which have basically been the wet dream of the pork producing industry for, about 25 years. And to join me today to talk about these new rules is my old pal, Amanda Hitt, with whom we have discussed this program several times over the last decade, which is so funny. Amanda is the director of the Food Integrity Campaign, which is part of the Government Accountability Project. She oversees the FIC operations and is responsible for ensuring that the Food Integrity Campaign fulfills its mission of enhancing food integrity by facilitating truth-telling. In other words, she's a whistleblower, or she works with whistleblowers. To do this, Amanda works closely with partner organizations, clients, legislators, and the media to alter the balance of power between the food industry and consumers. She acts to protect the rights of those who speak out against the practices that compromise food integrity and empower whistleblowers and food activists. So you need to follow Amanda Hitt, H-I-T-T. Amanda, welcome back to the show. It's great to hear your voice, girlfriend.
Oh, I know. It's so exciting to hear from you too, Katie.
Thank you very much.
Hey, look, what about 10 years, huh?
What about 10 years?
Doing this stuff.
Yeah.
Both of us. I'm just like, wow. And for 10 years, we've been talking about the same thing.
And, I know, and, that's and what's said, so great.
And so what's so great, yeah. But no, but we've been talking, let's never, you know, let's stop this from happening. You know, Let's do our best. And here it is.
It happened. The pork industry has finally achieved its ultimate goal, which is they started not lobbying for this. When was the first hemp program put into place? It was like 1997, right?
Well, right, yeah. So I mean, it's poultry and it's pork. They both have pilot programs in poultry and pork. But it, about 1997 is when pork started.
Yes, and hemp stands for Hazard Analysis and Critical Control Point, HACCP-based inspection models project. Except that this time around, they're not calling it that. They're calling it NSIS. Is there some significant difference?
Well, I guess it sounds more like the television show, and so I guess it's more and people are just NCI. No, I you know they changed the name because they want to sort of roll it out as something new. You know, they don't want to say, oh, this is something old we've been doing that's been failing for 20 years.
Right.
They want to say, oh no, this is NSIS, right? And it's And also, I think we've talked about this before. So HIMP, which was the name of HIMP, was the name of the pilot program.
Right.
But part of that acronym was an acronym. So it was. I think if you've got an acronym within an acronym, you know you've got a conspiracy on the doorstep, right? Like, you know something's going wrong.
Yes. I think you can safely say that maximum confusion and obfuscation is the watchword of the day.
It might be.
Oh, Jesus. So what is that? Let's see. So this started in 1997. Let's just quickly remind people of the point of this new program, once called HIMP, now called NSIS. Like, this was designed, supposedly this is to modernize and to make safer our pork supply. But in fact, what does it really mean?
It's in a nutshell, it's privatized. It's just privatization.
Oh, good way of putting it.
It's just a new way of modernize is a new way to say privatize. And that's what you're doing. You're seeing the role of the federally funded meat inspector.
Yeah.
That role is now being given to the plant itself.
That's
so
right.
The workers at the plants are going to now be doing this, the inspection activities of the people that put the stamp on your meat, right? So that USDA inspected, that's now going to be, just imagine that low-wage immigrant worker, undocumented, being exploited stamp of approval.
Yeah, like, that's what it's going to be.
That's what it's going to be. So that's where we're headed. This is the first step in that.
That it is. So now I actually went so far as to not only read the press release, which of course I got, but also to then read the actual final rule. So let me get my glasses off here so I can actually see this, because I'm reading it off of my phone, of course. In the final rule, here was a very telling paragraph in the USDA press release. This is a quote now. In the final rule, FSIS, that's the Food Safety and Inspection Service, amends the regulations to require all swine slaughter establishments to develop written sanitary dressing plans and implement microbial sampling to monitor process control for enteric pathogens that can cause foodborne illness. And the final rule, listen to this, folks, also allows market hog establishments to choose if they will operate under NSIS or continue to operate under traditional inspection. So why, if this is such a fantastic new model, modernizing and improving food safety, why would you allow plants to opt out of that?
Yeah, right. If it's the next best thing and the only best way, then there would be no option, right? I mean,
right.
This is what we'd be doing. I just want to catch you on something that you said that I think a lot of people, and especially your listeners, maybe they just heard you say this, but they didn't realize that you were actually saying, like, there's a term of art in what you just said. There was a word in there that's kind of, market hogs, like hogs for market, right? This is commerce.
Right.
But it's not what you think. A market hog is a type of pig. It's a healthy, under 2-year-old pig that is reasonably disease-free by virtue of age and, like, not being injured and not being, a poor, like, given, dosed up with ractopamine, so it's a downer pig, you know,
right.
Ractopamine is a hormone that they give to fat, well, muscle them up.
Yep.
So it's a market hog is an actual thing, and nobody's talking about this, and I don't know why, but meat inspectors know this. If the animal is a very healthy pig to start with,
yeah,
then this system can work pretty much clean and free, because if there's nothing to inspect because it's a healthy pig.
I see.
Everything should be fine. But here's the deal. That's not the pigs that are running through these high-speed slaughter facilities, these new inspection rules, right? That's not what's happening. The healthy pigs are gone. They're running sick and elderly pigs and pigs that shouldn't be even allowed in the system. So... Oh. Think about that. And nobody's talking about this, and I don't know why. They don't actually have enough pigs to feed this high-speed slaughter system.
You're kidding,
what are they
really?
Going to do? No. And I don't know why this... Like, I've talked to lots of media. You're the only one who listens, Katie. If it wasn't for you and your listeners, I would be done.
That's not
but
true.
No, but, you know, the big guys don't want to hear that.
No.
They don't want... They want the select, you know, oh, it's gross, the gross, the ooh, the ah, the, you know.
Yeah.
But they don't want the little nitty gritty, which is this one little word could make or break this system. If we flood this system with sick pigs, Katie, it won't work.
Yeah,
it
right.
It won't work. Right?
Well, I'm anticipating quite an uptick in foodborne illnesses. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, why are we like? I'm like, why am I doing this job anymore? Like, yeah. I'm not going to wait for the next big death, you know? Like,
yeah, true.
But that's what they're asking. So that's what the USDA is saying. Well, we'll deal with this when, you know, somebody's child dies. You know, like, that's ridiculous. Like, you're going to keep on giving these industry bonuses away and throwing these bones to the industry and making them happy. And they're doing it, and it very intentional. Well, one, you've got Trump, and he hates regulation, right?
Right.
So this is a nice time to run crazy with this rule. But I want to add something else. And this wasn't in the news too much, but it's very real, too. You follow this stuff. You know what's going on in China with the virus
I
and
do.
All the pigs being culled and all the killings.
Major swine fever, yeah.
So that's what, yeah. Well, guess what? Who's going to fill that deficit? The U.S., right?
Yes,
because
we are.
We burst open this regulatory thing. We deregulated our pigs, so we dump all our pigs into the market, filling that void that was left there with China. China's the number one consumer of pork.
But aren't the tariffs, or did they cut a deal on pork? I think they did cut a deal on the pork thing. Yes,
but,
right.
Yeah, it's all working out perfect.
Yep.
If you're anybody who's listening and said, why do I care, like, was held back for since 1997? Because it was a really stupid idea.
Yeah.
Well, all the everything kind of aligned. I mean, in a way that I could never have predicted.
Yeah.
And here we are on the phone, you know, after you and I talking about this for so long, finally saying, here it is.
Here it is. They finally got it. They finally, you know, like I keep calling it the pork producer's wet dream. I mean, oh my God, we can throw any old animal we want in there because nobody's going to be inspecting it. So here's another little piece of verbiage from either the press release or from the actual rule. And that is to, quote, remove unnecessary regulatory obstacles to industry innovation by revoking maximum line speeds and allowing establishments flexibility to reconfigure evisceration lines. Okay, that scared the crap out of me.
I think a regulatory agency saying they don't want to stifle innovation by increasing line speeds sounds insane.
It's insane.
Right? Like, what are you doing? What is that? How is that going to make you more innovative to speed up something wrong so that it goes at a more deadly pace? Like, I consider myself pretty innovative. Like, oh, if I, you know, I'm having trouble, I'm short, right? You've seen me and you know how I am.
Yes.
So I'm a short person. You know it. You're like, oh, wow, this is a short lady. I'm innovative because I can't reach things, right?
Right.
I come up with creative ideas. I'm not innovative because I'm being chased by a Doberman. You know what I mean? Like, that's not my most innovative moment. And that's basically what these racing down these lines at, you know, these breakneck speeds.
Yes.
So that's not innovative. That's not. And I guess they're saying, well, if they put out a bunch of diseased animals, they're going to have to get innovative with how well they're checking for it.
Well, how well they're checking for it and what kind of baths they're dipping them in.
Be
you know,
right.
Like what kind of chemicals are they going to be using to kill those pathogens? That's
well,
what I think about, you know. Because change the speed and also to change up the rules around evisceration, like taking out the contents of the animal's, you know, internal cavities, including their intestines, which could break and spill into, you know, I mean, it's just, I mean, I love meat, but this really makes me think twice about where I'm going to be eating meat next. You know what I mean? It's just disgusting.
Yeah,
really
you know,
nasty.
That's the thing too. You told people, the folks listening, who I am, right? So I'm a whistleblower person. I get inside. I'm an attorney, and I help people tell the truth who are locked up in these institutions, not mental, but bad as that, plants and slaughter plants and stuff. I help them tell the truth, right? And here's what they tell me every time, and this is what everybody needs to hear. I would never eat that stuff. Like, that's what they're telling me.
Yes.
They would not eat the products that come out of their own plants. And they're the inspectors. So,
I've heard that from USDA inspectors as well.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
I mean,
I had a chicken inspector stay at my B&B last summer, and she was like, I'm just saying to you, don't be eating that.
Yeah, don't eat it. Oh, yeah, I've never met a hog inspector who doesn't eat pork, right?
Right.
But I've never met one that ate it from any kind of USDA facility. They'll get them custom slaughtered.
Right.
But they won't eat pork. So it's not like they have some weird, oh, it's gross to see it slaughtered. They're not weird like that. They're weird, like, not weird at all. They're scared.
It's called self-preservation, I think, is very sensible. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's not grossed out by this process. It's It's grossed out by the
failure of the process.
Failure of the process.
Yeah.
There you go.
So here's another scary development, which you alluded to already, which is that the plant personnel will be in charge of sorting out the sick, diseased, or otherwise, again, I'm quoting, otherwise unfit animals from the production line. And this apparently is going to give USDA inspectors more time to get on with something. But what exactly? The rule allows for up to two offline verification inspectors per line per shift and reduces the number of online inspectors to a maximum of 3 per line per shift. That means, and people should understand how many hogs are moving through these plants per day. We're not talking a couple of hundred. We're talking in the thousands of hogs. You know, maybe 10,000 hogs are being processed a day in any given major hog facility with the consolidation of the industry. That's pretty much how it goes. And so the idea that only one or two or maybe three guys per shift is looking at 5,000 hogs going down the road, that's terrifying. What are they supposed to be doing? They're supposed to be swabbing for antimicrobials or something like that, right?
Right. Well, that's maybe part of the problem, because my understanding from working with these meat inspectors, both poultry and pork, we're talking about pork today, but both tell me this.
Right.
There's no accuracy in that testing. So you're saying, well, let's not rely on those organoleptic, you know, the derogatory way the agency calls it. They call it poke and sniff, right?
Yeah.
So just the looking and, you know, like they're like, oh yeah, that's old fashioned. We're gonna think about antimicrobials and pathogen testing, which sounds good.
It does.
But if they're not even doing that correctly, or doing it in such a way that it's not accurately reading the amount of pathogen that's actually going through the line, then it's hardly worth investing in that new technology.
Yes.
But because the agency refuses to invest in its own personnel and listen to them when they have complaints about this, and instead rely solely on the plant's self-evaluation of how safe they are, this continues to happen. And here we are today, like in this perfect storm, relying on a scientific modern way that maybe isn't working, that itself is failing. So there's really not a lot of joy in this picture. There's not a big smiley face, no emoticon at the end of this. It's really, now we wait and see. And you said something there. You said, well, these industries are, collapsed into themselves, and they've become, these giant, monstrosities, these giant mega companies, and they're slaughtering tens of thousands of, these 10,000 animals a day and stuff. If one animal passes a pathogen in that stream, they call it the comet effect. So if it even though the blast comes from one animal, let's say a bad pathogen blast, that comet has a tail, right? And that tail will go down the line and spread. So you're looking at many, many thousands of pounds of contamination from maybe just one sick animal.
Right.
So it's not like it's just contained. And the other thing is, so much of our meat is mixed together. Not as much as beef and hamburger, because how many cows went into your hamburger? It's like, anybody's guess, right? But you mean certainly sausage, and there's certainly other meats and
ground beef, ground pork. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So it really is, unfortunately, a matter of time before people get sick. I do want to say one other little thing about that.
Yes, indeed.
So an inspector said this to me, and I'm going to say it to you because I think it really drives it home. The pathogens that, plague pork are not as virulent or as deadly as, let's say, E. coli, 0157 in beef, right? People know that it's the killer. But my inspector friend says to me, she said, pork won't kill you, but it will make you wish you had died. Because the illness is so extreme. Like, it's a very severe, you can get really, really sick from pork. But it doesn't have that profile of 0157,
right,
where people say, oh yeah, you're dead, you're done, Because it does, everybody knows Jack in the Box, right? That horrible outbreak. So, but it will think about that. It will make you want to die or wish you had died.
And I'm sure with someone who's immunocompromised, the elderly or a child, it probably could kill you very easily. I mean, why not? I'm going to, let's take a short break and have a quick sponsor drop, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit more about the line speeds with Amanda Hitt from the Government Accountability Project. Stay tuned.
Since the mid-1800s, before Wisconsin was even recognized as a state, its resident cheesemakers have been putting the art into artisan cheese. When early settlers from Switzerland, Germany, and Italy came to Wisconsin, they brought their cheesemaking expertise with them. They chose Wisconsin because the terroir reminded them of the homes they'd left behind in Northern Europe. The soil and water of Wisconsin is nurtured by the goodness of glacial sediment, and those elements lend themselves to the very best milk. Today, Wisconsin's cheesemakers draw from their rich European heritage and cheesemaking traditions, and combine them with incredible innovation to produce half of the nation's specialty cheese. Wisconsin cheesemakers never stop experimenting, trying to improve, and dreaming of your next favorite cheese that has yet to be imagined. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Linda Liu, and I'm the host of Feast Meets West, the show that celebrates Asian culture through the lens of food here on HRN. Listen to episodes like The Evolution of Chinatown with Num Wa Tea Parlor's Wilson Tang and New York Times' Elaine Chen. Catch our ongoing series, Women in Asian Food, and spotlight episodes with our heroes like Anita Lowe. You can find Feast Meets West wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Alrighty then, we're back. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. My name is Katie Kiefer. I'm talking to Amanda Hitt from the Government Accountability Project. She is the director of the Food Integrity Campaign. She and I have been buddies for about 10 years now, ever since Timothy Pacherat told me about you for his book, because you consulted with him for his book, Every 12 Seconds, which was a fantastic read about the meat industry. It took me a while to remember who it was that introduced me to you, Amanda, but it was Tim Pacherat. Anyway, to go on, we were talking about the NSIS, formerly known as HIMP, and they're saying that it's going to lead to lower levels of various forms of pathogens, such as salmonella. But the other thing that they are expecting in the new inspection system is that it will improve animal welfare and compliance with the, what is HMSA? I was thinking that was...
It's the Humane Methods of Slaughter Act.
Humane Methods of Slaughter Act. Yes, that's what it is, of course. Because more FSIS resources will be available to verify the humane handling of animals. Well, I mean, why did they even bother to toss that bone in there? Because you know ain't happening.
I do know people in the animal welfare community who were actually thrown for that bone. They actually chased it. So what they did, and they were like, oh my gosh, I can't even believe I believe that, you know.
Yeah.
But what the agency is doing there is they're saying, well, now we'll have more time to do, it's called antemortem, so before death, observations of the animals,
right.
And make sure that they're healthy, and also sort of tracking them through the process, because you know we'll have a mobile inspector.
Uh-huh.
But what they don't, which would be more animal welfare protection, if they didn't increase the line.
Right.
But since they increased the line, that means many thousands more animals are not going to be inspected.
Exactly.
There's going to be more. So it's like, I think that's when you see stuff like that, that's when you get, it's hard. I mean, I'm always skeptical of the agency, but I try very hard not to be cynical.
Uh-huh.
But when you see stuff like that, you're like, well, isn't that obviously a way to
it's
lie?
A contradiction in terms.
I mean, yeah, there's going to be more time to do it, but there's going to be many times more animals. So
right.
How could you possibly see that as a win for animals?
Like right.
You can't. But a lot of animals, not a lot, a couple, like in my world, like were like kind of, they called and asked about it. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, well, if you can throw somebody, and like, you think about these big organizations, like the Humane Society or whatever.
Yeah.
They have to allocate their lobbying time to you know, what they can.
Yes,
and
of course.
A regulation like this isn't going to be a threat to their farm animal program, then they'll move on.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes a little bone like this is enough to throw someone off. And that's when you realize your regulators, they're not working for you. They're not. They, unfortunately, they're working for the very institutions that they're charged to regulate.
That's right. I mean, it's truly the fox guarding the hen house. It's a ludicrous idea. I mean, they've already said in an earlier paragraph that they're reducing the number of inspectors per shift.
Yeah.
So, you know, like you're adding thousands of animals to the line, and then you're dialing back how many actual USDA inspectors are in the house. So I mean, you know, that's just crazy. And then one more thing about the line speed, which is an important thing to recognize in terms of worker safety. When you increase the line speed, you know, you have an exponential increase in injuries that are both accidental, like you've just cut yourself with a knife or run your fan through the meat grinder, or you have injuries that are from repetitive motions. And then, of course, there was Ted Genoway's famous chapter in his book, The Chain, about the workers who were blowing the pig's brains out of their skulls and they developed these horrible neurological diseases. You know, okay, so where is that? Where is the worker safety issue here? I mean, where is that standing? Do you have any statistics about that? I didn't have a chance to look for that.
Back when we were doing, we had a WTF Hormel campaign, and we had this infographic, and I think I was like, there's 30,000 repetitious motions a line worker will make during his shift. Or her shift.
Yeah.
So think of those 30,000 cuts or chops, basically.
Yeah.
So if you're not even considering like chopping off your hand as a problem, which is real.
Yes.
you are definitely looking at the muscular skeletal, you know,
long-term injuries. Yes.
You can't say speeding up the lines won't affect that because that's what's happening, right? You're doing more of those repetitions.
Right.
And I don't think you have to be, you know, an exercise physiologist to know that that's going to cause a problem. And it's usually in the form of, you know, most people are aware of carpal tunnel. But carpal tunnel can be so much worse than you typing the wrong way on your MacBook. The issue can be much more exaggerated than I think the average person would think.
Oh, sure.
The wrist of someone with carpal tunnel can swell to the size of their forearm so that you can't actually see the difference. You can't see where that wrist indents because the forearm just melts into that huge swollen wrist.
Right.
I have had meat inspectors say that they've seen workers with wrists like that just pushing through because they're afraid to use the company doctors.
Of course.
You know, if you're the one that caused a workplace injury, then nobody gets free pizza on Tuesday.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's so many reasons that you wouldn't come forward with that kind of injury, but there's no reason why you wouldn't get that kind of injury. So you have to know that that's the expendable workforce that we're dealing with here.
Well, that's why we have no immigration reform, right? It's because essentially these are the people, it's the undocumented aliens who work in these slaughter plants. And we saw that in Missouri when they had that big ICE raid. Was it Missouri or Mississippi? Excuse me, in Mississippi.
Mississippi,
the Koch brothers. And they, you know, rounded up 700 people. Oh, what? These people are undocumented? We didn't know that. But that's why they want them, because they can get rid of them as soon as they have an injury or they make a fuss about the fact that they can't go off the line to take a pee or have something to eat or, you know, I mean, it's just, it's mind blowing. I mean, it's literally, modern day slavery, which we just turn a blind eye to. And it's, you know, and this is why we don't have meaningful immigration reform in this country, because all the way from farm to plate, you have undocumented workers being exploited so that we can all enjoy cheap food. And that's the long and the short of the story, right?
Well, that's it. Yeah, we're not paying the real price, but someone's paying the price for food. most consumers don't pay the price for food, but somewhere along the line, someone has to pay. And if it's not a someone, it's the environment, because none of this goes without consequence. Because to feed these giant high-speed slaughterhouses, you have to feed them with giant pooping pigs.
Yes.
And those giant pooping pigs poop into big giant poop lagoons, and guess what? Because of the state of our world, giant hurricanes come and spread those lagoons all over, pulling people's water and houses, and it just goes on and on. It's not it's not something you're doing without a consequence, and it might be something that you could stop or reduce or just be aware of that could make a lot of difference in the way our world is working. And a lot of people are afraid to talk about it that way, but, I mean, here's what happened to me. I used to be real open. You know me. I'm real open to things. But I visited a woman whose home, her family home, gets sprayed with pig feces. To drain those lagoons I was talking about earlier, they have to spray them out in fields.
Yeah.
They spray this.
For fertilizer, quote unquote.
But it's not. It's too high in phosphorus. So they spray it, and it sprays all over this woman's home.
Oof.
You know, it sprays all over her car. It makes her house stink. And she's a together lady. She's an older woman. Her name's Renee Miller. And she told her story about how hard she tried to stop this spraying from happening. And she went to the police. And then guess who owns the spraying farm, the farm that's doing the spraying? The sheriff of the town.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my God, right?
Yeah.
So it's like it doesn't get much. Like, the story just gets worse and worse.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, I said, well, Renee, is there anything, like, if you could tell anyone, you know, how to help, like, get, and not that you haven't helped yourself, because God knows she has.
Yeah.
She said, the one thing I'd ask people to do, just don't support this industry.
Right.
Just don't do it. And so, you know what? Now, if I get a mic, I'm saying it. Like, you can't be a part of something like that. It's so rotten.
Yeah.
And it's not like buying clothes from Walmart. And not that that's maybe a good thing either, but people, well, it was made in sweatshops. But it doesn't stop at a sweatshop. It hits every facet of our life when
that is
we support industries like this.
Yes.
It even echoes into racism.
Oh,
so
totally.
Even social injustice. Like, you're feeding into racist paradigms when you're eating these, you know,
factory-farmed chickens and pigs.
Yeah,
because
it's
they
awful.
Locate those plants in low-income areas, right?
Well, not
I mean,
even
North
that.
Carolina is like
yeah, North Carolina, right?
Perfect
so
example
Miller,
of that. Yeah,
Renee Miller, the woman I was. She's a black woman. She lives in a historically black neighborhood. They bought a black area of North, very rural, very rural, right? The land around her is cheap. Well, that's where they spray the poop.
Yes, of course.
I mean, this woman's family graveyard is in a poop field.
Oh God!
So she and her family went to bury, you know, their loved one.
Yeah.
They turned the sprayers on the funeral.
Oh, man.
So if you want to support that,
you
go ahead. But as for me, like, my days of being kind of like, oh, even and on, you know, I hear everybody out. I just, man, this is just, I don't know if there's another side to that. I just don't know if there is.
Well, the good news is that Murphy Brown was sued and they lost.
Yeah.
And the plaintiffs won. People like Renee Miller
win.
Now, whether that the award that they were supposed to get is going to remain as robust as it was is questionable. I'm sure that it'll be many, many years, if ever, that these people see a single dime. But at least it made a precedent for other communities to be able to sue against this. I've said for years, ever since I wrote that meat book, I have said for years that companies should be responsible with the contract farmers that they are working with. They should be responsible for disposing of waste. It should not be a carrying expense for a contract farmer who is making pennies on the dollar to raise these animals. I mean, that just should absolutely become the responsibility of the industry to install appropriate waste disposal techniques in every single contract farm that they work with. I mean, there is just no excuse for what's going on. Whether they got to truck that stuff out in a honey wagon and do whatever they have to do with it, put it in a giant, you know, anaerobic digester 50 miles away, I don't care. But that should not be sprayed on communities, you know, of any stripe. And it's having a terrible impact on our water tables. I did a whole series on water and about this because of the two hurricanes last year in North Carolina. But Amanda, we have to go back to, because we're almost out of time.
I know. You know what, though? You know more than anybody, like, or most anybody.
Well, more than the average bear. Yeah, that's true.
It's not, you're, if you pull at it, it's like, it's that Weezer
That's
song
right.
about pulling the sweater.
Yes.
If you pull that string, the whole sweater falls apart.
Yep.
And I don't know if we can ever talk about it the same again. It's always going to be, you know, the interconnectedness is just too apparent after a while. But anyway, back to hemp.
Back to him. Okay, so I have one more question, and then let's talk about your 10-year anniversary and our 10-year anniversary just for the last couple of minutes. So the all-important point here, really, when it all comes down to it, is how much money are they going to save by doing this? How much is this going to be worth to the industry as a whole to be able to run those lines faster, to be able to do away with a lot of that inspection, to be able to pass a lot of meat off as wholesome when it really should not be in the line? How much do you think that's going to add to the bottom line of those big pork producing companies?
The savings like Smithfield. I've heard, it's $3.78 million. That was an actual number that they had in savings. But it's going to increase production by 12.5%. That's that 12.5% is exactly the wedge that China's leaving out, right? So that's why that becomes important.
Right. And again, like you said, it's like the thread connect the sweater. You just pull that thread. Oh my God. Well, that's an eye opener. So let's talk about the Government Accountability Project and the gala that you guys are hosting in November. What's the date?
Well, it's November 15th. The Government Accountability Project is the parent whistleblower company.
Right.
Organization.
But we're celebrating the Food Integrity Campaign,
which is celebrating 10 years, just like you.
Yes.
So that's November 15th at American University Washington College of Law. There are co-sponsors of that event. And we're looking to have some really exciting speakers and panelists, including, if you're interested in today's topic, that will be a topic of discussion with leaders from the worker rights movement, the animal welfare movement, and sustainable agriculture movement. So they'll be there. Contract rowing, if that's kind of your thing, we'll have whistleblower contract rowers and the people that have advocated for them for years. Those are the folks that are they're just these horrible predatory loans and that kind of thing. But it's also just it's like, wow, this is a good guys, you know? And we're going to also have some, for the more lawyerly types, if there's any lawyers out there, we're going to talk a little bit about the barriers to truth-telling. So a lot of people, obviously whistleblowing, knowing your whistleblower rights is a big deal, but still people are afraid of, like, veggie libel and defamation. And how real are those when you want to come forward with, you know, a disclosure of waste, fraud, and abuse? How real are those things? So that's just a great bunch of speakers and panelists. You can that landing page, I believe, is up, and it's you can find us at foodwhistleblower.org, and you'll see a link, or you can do /FIC10, Food Integrity Campaign 10, FIC10, and you will you'll learn more about the other events that we're also hosting during that week.
And you can read their blog and learn more about the programs and platforms that the whole shebang is working on, in addition to the Food Integrity Campaign, but all the other great programs that you guys are engaged with. That's also available on your website, but whistleblower.org, that's the thing. Amanda, thank you so much for joining me today. This will not be the last time we speak, I'm sure, but I will see you on November 15th. I'll be down
there
to womp and poi with you. So thanks again, honey, for joining me. And folks, if you're interested in our Heritage Radio Gala, and that goes for you too, Amanda, if you want to come up to the city, our 10th year anniversary is Monday, November 11th, and that's taking place at the Palm House and Yellow Magnolia Cafe in the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens. If you've never been there, it's worth the price of admission just to see the glass house. Really, really beautiful, or I should say the Palm House. And that's always a great time. We have great food and raffles and auctions. It's a fundraiser for us. So thanks so much for listening today, and thanks to my sponsor, and see you next week with another great show. Thanks to my engineer, Amanda, as well, and especially my guest, Amanda Hitt. Thank you, folks. So long for now. What Doesn't Kill You is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.